From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's a special edition of WHQR's pre-election day coverage. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and I want to take this moment to welcome Ben Schachtman, who has been a periodic contributor to Coastline. So you would have heard his voice on these airwaves frequently if you're a regular listener. But he is now WHQR's new and first managing editor. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me, Rachel. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm so happy to have you here. Let's start with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling. This is recent. It's ruled that North Carolina's state election board may extend the absentee ballot deadline to November 12th, providing those ballots are postmarked by Election Day, November 3rd. Now, this is a political loss for state Republicans who wanted the deadline extended just 3 days after Election Day. Can you help us unpack why Republicans opposed that larger extension so strenuously?
Sure. So this is a political drama that's kind of playing out at two levels, at the federal level and at the state level. Obviously, the Trump campaign has been fighting battles in various states to limit modifications to the absentee ballot process, with the thought that ballots delivered later are going to skew Democratic. And so there would be a benefit to the Trump campaign over the Biden campaign in limiting those. But at the state level, this is, you know, there's a similar logic there, but it's also about the way this process played out. And so what happened was State Attorney General Josh Stein and the North Carolina State Board of Elections came to an agreement to sort of allow absentee ballots to get fixed without filing new ballots, without getting too much into the weeds. It basically would help more ballots get counted. And the entire State Board of Elections unanimously agreed to this, but shortly afterwards, two Republican members resigned, saying they either didn't fully understand the ramifications of what they had voted for, or more pointedly, that the lawyers who helped them come to this agreement hadn't fully explained what was going on. And so it's become the argument of the state GOP that this is a usurping of power by an appointed board over the legislator, and that this sets a very unfortunate precedent. And I mean, immediately the effect on our election means that we're going to have a longer time period for ballots to be counted. But this is also an issue that's going to come back. The Supreme Court left themselves space to come back and revisit this issue. And you definitely haven't heard the last of the conflict between the state GOP and the Board of Election.
Right. Now, we are seeing what we think are unprecedented numbers in early voting. From the day that North Carolina opened up the polls for early voting, we saw lines, wondered if those lines could be sustained through Election Day, and we were just going to see unprecedented turnout overall. But what are the numbers that we're seeing now? How much has this gone up, and what does that mean?
So we're still seeing pretty strong turnout. The first day where we heard stories of, you know, hour, 2 hour waits. In New Hanover County, it was around 8,500 votes were cast in early voting stations around New Hanover County that day, and also large numbers in Brunswick County. And that number has sort of slowly decreased to about 6,000, and then in the last couple of days, it's been closer to 4,000 days. But all those numbers are higher over 2016 and 2012. And looking, both Brunswick County and New Hanover County have done a really nice job breaking down who's actually voting where and when. So if you want to go into the weeds, you can check out their Board of Elections pages. But yeah, the numbers are really, really high.
And are we seeing, you know, typically in past presidential election years, Democrats benefit during the early voting period, we see more Republicans voting on Election Day. Is that what we're continuing to see with these numbers?
No. And I think there's been a lot of speculation in national media coverage about what some people have called the red mirage and the blue shift, where, especially because a lot of the Trump campaign's messaging has been about voting in person. But to give you an example, in New Hanover County, right now, the grand totals are 22,000 Democratic voters almost 29,000 Republican voters. And of course, because we are such a purple area, around 26,000 unaffiliated voters. And that doesn't mean Libertarian, Green Party, or Constitutional Party. Those are just, you know, unaffiliated voters. And we don't know how their votes are going to land.
Right. And that's a block that we've seen continuing to grow. I mean, that has grown over the last several years, and we're getting to the point now where unaffiliated voters, as when we look at the number of registered voters, actually outnumber both parties. Isn't that right in New Hanover County?
Absolutely. They're really a plurality. And it's interesting because some of them are single voter, sort of, you know, unaffiliated, where there's one issue they don't feel like either party is really doing the right approach to things. And then some of them are really, you know, what we might consider split ballot voters of the 90s and early 2000s, where they would vote, you know, maybe a Democratic governor and a Republican president. But, you know, that's really a mystery box for us right now, because at the end of the day, you really don't know how those unaffiliated votes broke down. But I think that's part of what makes New Hanover County so interesting and kind of so important.
Right, which leads right to the question of whether New Hanover County is, in fact, a bellwether county for the presidential election. Is New Hanover County representative of the country? And is it an indicator of how the presidential election is likely to go? I mean, we do have some conflicting data on that, but there is a good case for why it can be representative. So first of all, explain why it's not really a question of numbers.
Sure. So we have heard a number of people interviewed who have said things like, you can't win North Carolina without winning New Hanover County. And so we just wanted to make it clear that there's no electoral college at the state level. There's no numbers game where you could win, you know, a small number of important counties and ignore the rest of it. That North Carolina is still a popular vote state. It's more symbolic. The makeup of New Hanover County looks a lot like North Carolina.
It really does. However, unlike what some national journalists have decided to say about New Hanover County, it does not have a large African American population, and that is not a factor in the way it has been described in terms of being a bellwether.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes that's sort of a prognostication shortcut, where you look at the black population and then you can try to dial in what you think the Democratic vote will be. New Hanover County actually has been losing over the last couple of years its black population. It's lower than the state average and lower than the national average. And from the people we've talked around in North Carolina, I think the big question will be turnout and how the unaffiliated vote splits. But I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, how the unaffiliated vote splits?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, we've heard political scientists talk about the fact that there are actually fewer independent voters than people like to think. And there are even fewer independent thinkers than people themselves would like to think. In fact, when people are given blind surveys, and I think this was something Shankar Vedantam talked about, it actually turned out that when a list of elements of a party platform was defined as Democratic or Republican, people tended not to look at the elements of the platform itself, but tended to agree or disagree based on the label that was given to those elements, which speaks to we think less independently than we think we do. I think a break is coming up in just a few minutes, but we need to acknowledge that voters this year are voting in districts, both legislative and congressional, that are good for one election. There was, because of the court battle over this and the back and forth, we now have maps that are just 2020. Next year's census, you know, the completion of this year's data means redistricting again. So there will be new maps for 2021, and North Carolina is expected to gain another congressional district. And the U.S. Census Bureau estimates right now show the state's population has grown about 10% since 2010 to 10.5 million. And that's part of a pattern that has happened across the South, growing faster than any other region in the country.
Absolutely. I think you're seeing two strong forces. One is the constant battle over gerrymandering districts in a way that benefits one party or the other, most recently Republicans, whose maps were struck down, and also the explosive growth, which, when the new census numbers come in, are probably going to, you know, have a pretty profound impact, especially along the coast.
That's right. North Carolina added 106,000 people in the last year, and that's more than any other state except Texas, Florida, and Arizona. So that makes us number four.
We're number four.
You're listening to WHQR special pre-election day coverage with the first and newest managing editor, Ben Schachtman. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When we come back after this break, we're going to take a closer look at some of the races that folks in the Cape Fear region will be deciding. You're listening to WHQR's special pre-election coverage. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn.
And I'm Ben Schachtman.
And we are looking today at the forces, the dynamics that are shaping the 2020 election, unpacking what you need to know. And on that note, Ben Schachtman, before we leave the redistricting that needs to happen for 2021 elections, have you seen any evidence? You and I have both been talking to the candidates running this year at the local and state level and some federal office. Do you think there's any real traction in terms of developing a nonpartisan expert panel to redraw those boundaries? I mean, for decades, you know, we watched the Democrats gerrymander their little hearts out. And then when the Republicans came in and won a supermajority, we saw gerrymandered districts that were struck down by courts. Do you think that folks are finally getting to the point where they will actually consider, as some other states have done, some sort of nonpartisan expert panel?
I think that's part of a bigger question about how much bipartisan cooperation we can expect to see in the future across the nation. But specifically about this, you know, here's a good example. In the state Senate District 9 race, both incumbent Harper Peterson and former state Senator Michael Lee both actually agreed that a third party might be the best option. Now, whether the rest of their respective parties agree with them, it's less clear. And I will say that, you know, the constant court battles are expensive, but it has allowed, most recently, as you pointed out, the Republican Party to effectively get their way and hold on to, you know, districts that are more gerrymandered than they might otherwise be. So I think the political will to continue to fight for a gerrymandered district exists. I just don't know at what point the two parties get exhausted enough of constantly going through the state and then Supreme Court to keep that fight up. But I don't think the battle's over in the near future.
So at this point, knowing we'll probably be wrong, what are we thinking about election results and when we'll be able to report them? When will we know? And do you think it's going to be different at the state and local levels versus the presidential race? We'll be up Tuesday night, November 3rd, bringing you live election results as they come in. What do you think is going to come in?
So I guess like this, like you point out, you're almost begging to be wrong. But a few things I think we can say with a good degree of being comfortable. One is that we've seen an unprecedented level of early voting, both one-stop voting and absentee voting. And those will go live on the state and local election board sites at around 7:30, as soon as the polls close. So what we'll have initially is a really good picture of what a larger than usual, compared to previous elections, portion of the population has done in terms of voting. So that's good, I mean, because we want to know more faster. But in terms of, you know, calling those races, I think locally it will look more or less like it has in the past. Even though every race can still accept absentee ballots, I still think locally we're going to be able to have some pretty clear pictures of what, you know, state legislator races and Board of Commissioners, Board of Education races look like by Wednesday morning. For statewide races, like governor and lieutenant governor, I think it might take a little longer. But the thing that we've been trying to drive home is that for the federal races, and especially the presidential election, we are looking at quite some time, more than a week.
Right. And some states, I guess by law, are not able to start counting their ballots early. North Carolina can, and that's something that usually swoops in as a dump of data on election night. When we look at Senator Tom Tillis versus his Democratic challenger, Cal Cunningham, you know, news broke several weeks ago about inappropriate texts. I think Cal Cunningham hasn't actually owned up to an affair, or whether there are more. And polls initially had been showing that voters generally didn't approve of his affair, but it wasn't enough to actually change their votes. Now, in a number of different polls, we're seeing that Cunningham's lead has shrunk to generally within a margin of error. And there was even a new WRAL poll in which, you know, Tillis is still trailing Cunningham, but he's making up ground. And there was a split of 48 to 45, which is down from that 49 to 39 lead that he'd built in a poll a couple of weeks earlier. And when you think about what the picture looked like a couple of weeks earlier, Tillis was coming off his coronavirus infection, and his colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee were starting the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett to fill the seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. So now that we're within this margin of error, do you want to make any projections on that, Ben Shachman?
Yeah, well, I'll say that this is, I mean, not a new phenomenon. We saw it, if you're like me and you remember the 90s all too well, we saw it with President Bill Clinton. We've obviously seen it with President Donald Trump. And what usually seems to turn the corner in terms of polls, you know, moral opprobrium doesn't seem to be enough to really shake the party faithful. What seems to work a little bit better is if you can connect the personal indiscretion or the affair or whatever it happens to be with a lack of judgment, right? So that's, and we, at least I saw watching sort of campaign ads on both sides, GOP ads made that argument that Cal Cunningham's affair, in addition to being odious, was also, you know, clearly represented some bad decision making. And that, you know, if the polls have shifted, I would attribute at least some of it to that, making that intellectual shift. I think it's going to be really close. I don't want to make a prediction because I feel I'd be wrong, but it did bring up a lot of interesting conversations about whether or not a person's personal life and personal mistakes are, one, fair game, and two, germane to what kind of candidate they are. Because we've definitely seen GOP people defend or ignore, you know, for example, President Trump's behavior, saying that what really matters is policy. So it did put some local Democratic supporters in that sort of same weird position where you have to do some mental gymnastics.
And Congressman David Rauser actually said to me when we talked several days ago that people who don't like President Trump don't like his personality. And I asked him where he diverges with President Trump on policy, and nothing came out of that. But I think that's a it, it's a support for the case that you're making about how someone is likely to legislate and shape policy. And in that race, North Carolina's 7th Congressional District, Republican Congressman David Rauser, formerly of Johnston County, he's now a New Hanover County resident, he's held this seat since 2014, seeking his fourth term, facing Democratic challenger Chris Ward. It's interesting. Nobody, there are no polls. There don't need to be. Nobody's right. looking at this race as a real contest. The last polling results from this district are from 2018 when Dr. Kyle Horton was challenging David Rauser. And she actually did better than any of his Democratic challengers had done. She lost by about 13 points instead of around 21 or 22. And she actually won New Hanover County, which is, again, that weird purpley thing that happens here.
Exactly. And I think, you know, had that been a New Hanover County only race, it would have gone to Horton. And the redistricting changes that we've seen over the years haven't really changed the overall makeup of Rauser's district. It's still overwhelmingly agrarian. It's pretty conservative. And you actually asked Mr. Ward some pretty pointed questions about his campaign, basically asking him, you know, you're outgunned 10 to 1 or more financially, and Rauser has a strong track record that he can run on. You know, why even bother doing this? What was sort of his response to that?
Well, he said he didn't use the term dreamer, but he said he's an optimist, and he said that his whole life is the story of his optimism and what he's been able to do growing up on a farm, basically, in rural North Carolina, and going to school and studying, you know, I think it was nuclear engineering. He really thinks that he has a shot. He recognizes he's an underdog. But, you know, this is a question that I think I ask the underdogs every year. Because when you're sitting on the outside of the race, there has to be the democratic exercise, and you want to see challengers, whether they have a shot or not. You know, you want to see the incumbents have to work to win that seat again. But, you know, so many of them say it's about building name recognition. I mean, that's actually something that Kyle Horton said 2 years ago when she was running against David Rauser, recognizing that was quite a long shot. But yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, that is a big part of it. And if you know, a lot of our local politicians, Woody White, Jonathan Barfield Jr., have run for federal office and not succeeded. But I think if you'd ask each of them, they would tell you they learned a lot about policy from the campaign. They learned a lot about how to run a campaign. So even though it can sometimes sound a bit like tilting at windmills when it's such a lopsided looking race, I think if you are, and I don't use this term disparagingly, if you plan on having a career in politics, right, I think you may need to go through that process. And why not start, you know, why not jump into the deep end and learn as much as you can?
Right. So let's look at the gubernatorial race in the state. That's something we haven't talked about very much. WHQR incumbent Roy Cooper, former state attorney general, and Republican challenger Dan Forrest, who's lieutenant governor. When you look at those two, it's interesting because in his last election, Cooper won the seat by a hair. It was just a few votes. Again, a reflection of North Carolina being such a purple state. But this year, Cooper is ahead in the polls by a pretty hefty double-digit margin. And yet, his executive orders, his policy on coronavirus has been incredibly controversial, and he's faced legal challenges over some of it. What do you make of that?
Absolutely. We've covered Cooper's executive orders exhaustively because they have, you know, such profound impact on our day-to-day life and the level of uncertainty. And at times, you know, there was a sense of caprice or arbitrariness about some of the orders. For example, you know, allowing brew pubs and distilleries and bottle shops to open while keeping bars closed. We got a large amount of listener and reader feedback about that, just trying to, maybe not even disagreeing with it, but trying to parse the logic behind it. And I do think that's generated a lot of frustration. But I think part behind that, though, is the idea that the pandemic is, for almost everyone, the first of its kind in their personal history. So there's a difference between having a plan and having a rough idea of what you would do and then actually executing that plan. So while people are frustrated with the executive orders, it's sometimes not clear. If you, for example, if you push critics of Cooper, what would you have done differently? They'll often sort of demur a little bit and say, well, no, I mean, I guess he sort of did the best he could with the information he had at the time. So, you know, I don't know if frustration with the pandemic is exactly the same as frustration with Cooper's reaction to the pandemic. And I don't know if that translates into people motivated to go to Dan Forest. But I will say the election has been a lot. It's been heavily about whether or not we open and how we reopen. Dan Forest, you've seen the billboards and the mailers that essentially say, I will reopen North Carolina, and basically focus on a different approach where, you know, it's up to the individual to avoid risk factors, as opposed to trying to mitigate those risks from a top-down government way, which has been Cooper's way. So that's how it looks to me.
Yeah, and I think we're also seeing that national divide among epidemiologists played out here, you know, like whether that's a viable strategy to allow people to make their own decisions and protect themselves. And probably beyond the scope of what we're doing here in this WHQR special pre-election coverage, even though it is not the pre-election. Election day is November 3rd, but many people have voted and are voting. Lieutenant governor race.
Yes.
There's been some interesting, I guess, social media content that
yes.
has emerged.
So this is the GOP's nomination for lieutenant governor is Mark Keith Robinson, who has a interesting Facebook history. What's interesting is that this is the kind of thing where you'd usually see someone canceled for this, you know. But he, when he was asked about it by WRAL and other news outlets, he basically doubled down and said, yes, I stand behind everything I've posted. Some of these things I can't repeat on the air. And WRAL made a similar decision. But he's been accused of anti-Semitism, homophobia. He has caused serious, he's called into question how serious COVID-19 was. And I think at this point, the story feels like it petered out a little bit because Robinson didn't apologize and he stood behind what he said. So it's pretty much up to the voter to say, you know, do these comments make me not want to vote for him? Or, you know, do I agree with him, or will I vote for him while holding my nose because I prefer that to Cooper's approach? So that's been an interesting sort of subchapter, and maybe another story for another time about what the lieutenant governor in North Carolina actually does. But he does actually have quite a bit of juice.
Yes. Now, in the Senate, in the state Senate, Republicans hold 29 seats, Democrats 21. We both heard Senator Harper Peterson say that one of his hopes for this election year, of course, is that Democrats gain a majority. And that would mean a five-seat move. Five seats. That's a lot of seats, Ben Shockman.
That's a lot of seats, Rachel. I'm not going to try and prognosticate here, but 2 years ago in 2018, the stated goal going into the election was to break the Republican supermajority, which they did with the victory of Peterson over Lee. So that really changed, and that pretty much set the stage for the trench warfare between the Democratic and Republican parties over the last 2 years, largely over the budget and Governor Roy Cooper's decision, like real concerted effort to push Medicaid expansion. So I don't know if the five-vote swing is doable, but I do know that the supermajority is definitely something that both sides are interested in. They've spent quite a bit of money in this district. Both candidates have spent around $700,000 as of the third quarter, and maybe something we can get into later, but there's been a lot of outside interest in terms of independent expenditure political committees, which most people know as super PACs. Just a lot of and also a lot of really tough campaigning, which is sometimes a nice way of saying mean campaigning. And
why is there so much outside interest?
Well, it's interesting because there's been a lot of PAC activity, not just in the Lee Peterson campaign, but also in the New Hanover County race, which is unusual. You usually don't see Raleigh-based PACs jumping into municipal and county races. And I think there's quite a bit of, you know, interest in how New Hanover County is developing. And again, it's one of 100 counties, but it's very representative of the issues that are going on in North Carolina. The sort of battle between property rights and environmental concerns, the sort of struggle for, you know, the souls of those unaffiliated voters. I think if you look at North Carolina as a whole, New Hanover County is a pretty good, you know, microcosm of all that.
Right. And so the thinking of the outside money with these from these super PACs is planting seeds in places like New Hanover County to develop either Republican or Democratic controlled policy making and outcomes.
Absolutely. And just to see, you know, to see what works. I mean, a lot of political campaigning is experimentation. If you watch, Facebook now has this really interesting utility called the Facebook Ad Library, where you can pull up a candidate's campaign or a super PAC and look at all of the ads they've ever purchased, who saw those ads, which is usually a good indication of who was targeted by those ads. And you can watch strategies change over time, see which issues they hit on, which demographics they try to focus on. And if nothing else, 2020 will be a really interesting document in terms of how that played out.
And North Carolina is actually seeing the third highest dollar amount in the country in terms of ad spending. Republicans are spending more in North Carolina, running more ads than Democrats. But Trump is still the underdog to win when you look at it from a national point of view. And there's definitely a block of political scientists who say TV ads don't change anything. But obviously no one's willing to test that theory at this point. You're listening to WHQR's pre-election day coverage during the election. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And managing editor Ben Schachman is with us today. We'll be right back after this quick break. You're listening to WHQR's special pre-election coverage during the election. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn.
And I'm Ben Schachman. Rachel, right before the break, we were talking about Michael Lee and Harper Peterson, and I want to linger on that for 1 minute, if that's okay.
Yes.
So this is, and we were talking about Facebook ads and TV ads and whether or not they work. And so I've spoken to both of these candidates because it's been such a tough and at times kind of brutal campaign. So I asked them both if they felt there was one piece of advertising from the other campaign that they felt was sort of off limits or wrong. Mm-hmm. So if I can, as a public service, I talk about two commercials real quick. The first is the one that Michael Lee objected to. And this is a campaign commercial from Harper Peterson that accused Michael Lee of voting to basically allow insurance companies to block people from coverage if they had pre-existing conditions. And so this tells you a little bit about how TV commercials work. It was so tricky to get to the bottom of this. You sort of had to go into the weeds of the North Carolina legislation website and see, how the bill was introduced, what amendments were posted. But long story short, it was a bill that would have created a new type of insurance for basically nonprofit companies that would fill certain gaps that the Affordable Care Act plans left open. And there was some concern that these health benefit plans would possibly be able to discriminate against people. So a motion was put forward, an amendment to this language that said, okay, so they can't discriminate you based on having had cancer or diabetes or any other precondition. And Michael Lee was one of the state senators in the Republican Party that voted to table this motion, and they replaced it with a different set of language that basically said, you can't discriminate, full stop. And the initial bill was approved with bipartisan support in the Senate. And then, interestingly, the bill got killed in the House because both parties agreed this was kind of too radical a shift of how insurance, it left too many uncertainties open, and ultimately they walked away from it. So, but the campaign ad, all it says is Michael Lee works for, you know, the big insurance companies, and he voted to deny you coverage if you have a pre-existing condition, which is not true. But to get to that answer, you really have to, like, go on a treasure hunt through,
So the technical element is true, but the political intent and the policy-making intent, which is more important, what that legislator was pursuing, is not true.
Yeah, and I think you could even say that the technical thing wasn't quite, because it was tabling a motion to constrain what these companies, which weren't technically insurance companies, with. But yeah, I think if you just drill down hard into like what was actually going on here, that campaign incident from the Peterson camp is not true.
Okay, so what's the one that Harper Peterson objects to?
And this is, yeah, so this is an ad that the two candidates actually discussed at the Wilmington Business Journal Power Breakfast last week, I believe. And it's an ad that alleges that Harper Peterson was sued by his ex-wife for child support. It's kind of a nasty move. I think a lot of people agreed. But it came out of information that was put out by the GOP Senate caucus. They do opposition research. So all of these documents, all the court documents were posted online. So it factually, anytime there's a child custody dispute, and that includes, you know, how much alimony child support gets paid, that is technically a civil suit. So you could say, yes, you were sued. Harper is pointing out that, you know, he is now friends with his ex-wife, and his daughter actually made campaign ads telling Michael Lee that he had gone too far with this. It was below the belt. And it's not clear if it moved the needle of all. If anything, it made the Lee campaign look insensitive. But the interesting part about that one was that that's actually not Lee's commercial. It's a commercial paid for by another one of these PACs, a very well-funded PAC called the, I believe it's Citizens for a Better North Carolina Senate, which incredibly well-funded and put a bit of money into this. And by law, super PACs aren't allowed to coordinate with candidates. So even if Michael Lee wanted them to stop running that ad, he's legally prohibited from calling them and saying, call off your dogs. Now, nothing stops him from condemning the ad, but this is something we saw in a number of races where people said, you know, why would any candidate want that happening? Well, the way the laws around super PACs are set up, they can't.
Right.
But again,
has he condemned the ad?
He has not. But he has said that it, you know, wasn't him, didn't come from his campaign. And it's another interesting piece because finding out where these ads come from and who's ultimately funding them can be a really torturous journey. And that took quite a bit of footwork to figure out. And I actually still, I'm open to any suggestions for people who know how to go down this wormhole in a better way. But after days of research, I wasn't actually able to find the end of the rope of PACs contributing to PACs. And all of this, I think, is part of the morass of campaign, you know, advertising, where it's often very difficult to know what the truth is behind a commercial. It's very difficult to know where the funding behind a commercial is coming from. And that leads me to another issue that we've talked about before, is whether or not any of this matters to people who've already decided they're going to vote a Democratic or a Republican ticket.
Right. And how many, you know, we know there are a lot of unaffiliated voters, but are they independent? That's the big unknown. But that also leads to some of the frustrations that I've had in terms of just, you know, having a political dialogue or having a dialogue about political agendas with candidates, incumbents and challengers. I was talking with current state representative Ted Davis from New Hanover County, who represents House District 19. However, this year, because of the redistricting, he is actually running as the incumbent in District 20, which was Holly Grange's district. She is not running. She ran for governor this year, lost the primary. So it's Republican incumbent Ted Davis versus Democratic challenger Adam Erickson. And, you know, Ted Davis talks about some of his abortion-related bills that he's sponsored and is very proud of. And one of those was about, you know, the Babies Born Alive Protection Act, which I was challenging him on. You know, is this something that is really necessary in terms of legislation? Once a baby is born alive, isn't that a human who is then protected by laws prohibiting homicide in this culture? And he didn't actually answer the question. And then on his website again, he says that he looked over when this bill failed, to see the Democrats, including Deb Butler, celebrating. And I asked him if he believed that his colleagues across the aisle, including Deb Butler, were celebrating the fact that they could murder babies, because this is when the political posturing kind of obscures the actual agenda. And I think most voters just want to know what their potential representatives are actually thinking about and what their political agendas are. And he actually said, yes, he believed that obviously Democrats want to murder babies because they were celebrating and because they didn't pass this bill. And that's, you know, that's some political obfuscation here. You know, if you want to ban abortion because you really believe that you're murdering humans, then that's your argument. But, you know, to jump through these political hoops, and this also came out in the Peterson Lee race, Senate District 9, when, you know, Michael Lee accuses Harper Peterson of voting against things like teacher pay raises, which everybody's in favor of. That's just an across the board agreement after we watched the exodus of educators in this state. And so many of the issues that Harper Peterson voted against, that Michael Lee can legitimately say he voted against, were a part of that larger budget bill that Democrats opposed because it did not include Medicaid expansion. And unless you drill down into that, and unless people really follow the budget debate, that's something that most people don't get from those moments when the political opponent says, well, he voted against teacher pay. Well, you know, this was part of a much larger conversation.
I agree. And I think you're touching on, you know, the root of a lot of superficial issues when we see things like Second Amendment, you know, sanctuary resolutions, or here in North Carolina, or sorry, in New Hanover County, there was a resolution to like condemn racism, where it doesn't move the needle in any kind of logistical policy way. But if you vote against it, you look foolish. It's political theater. And then there are, you know, hard decisions that people have to make, you know, at the behest of a party whip or, you know, the party headquarters, because it's for the greater good, you know, not voting for the budget because you're holding out for a better budget. But those kinds of political, you know, machinations, right? Filibusters, empty resolutions, stuff like that. I mean, that's when in my conversations, that's often given as the prime example of why people are unaffiliated, is right. Sort of a frustration with the amount of time politicians appear to spend on that kind of infighting compared to how much time they spend on policy. Now, the reality is politicians on both sides of the aisle that I talk to spend a heck of a lot of time researching bills and, you know, having meetings and like really drilling down into policy. But the public perception that they are, you know, to be blunt, wasting their time with territorial matches like that is behind the frustration. And, you know, I would wager to say at least a main component of the growing unaffiliated body in New Hanover County, and, you know, and the state too.
Let's look at New Hanover County for a second, because this is a pretty interesting county commission race. There have been some strange public alliances.
Yes.
That we would not have expected.
I feel like you were talking about current Board of Commissioners Chairwoman Julia Olson Bozeman.
Yes.
So, and, you know, we have seen in the past, I'm reminded of former Republican County Commissioner Beth Dawson, who broke ranks to side with Jonathan Barfield and other Democrats. Olson Bozeman has not always voted the way you would expect a Democratic candidate to, or a councilman to vote. I'm butchering that. She's a commissioner. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But in any case, you know, I think there was a lot of critique thrown her way from the more liberal progressive wing of the county party, especially over the hospital issue. I mean, that was really just cut right to the core of it, but also on WAVE. And I think that's a real sort of interesting part of what the new board will look like, specifically for the hospital thing. And I just wanted to touch on this real quick because we get a lot of questions about it. A lot of people had the sense that the hospital sale was effectively a done deal, and that's not 100% true. And this has a lot to do with the election, because a new board of county commissioners, like do a thought experiment where Kyle Horton, who was against the sale, and Leslie Cohen, who was against the sale, join Jonathan Barfield, who had questions about the sale but ultimately backed it, join Rob Zappel, who had questions about the sale, on the board of commissioners. And that now looks a lot different, and that new board could actually back out of the sale. It would be politically difficult because the county would have to pay $25 million.
Right.
And they'd have to do it quickly because it has to be done before the sale is closed. But they could actually effectively undo the vote that we saw last month. So I'm sure that's on some people's minds.
New Hanover County's Board of Education.
That's the appropriate tone.
Yeah. It's fraught.
It's fraught. We are, again, like the Board of Commissioners, we're guaranteed to see at least some new faces on this. And it's an interesting race because I spoke to two different candidates from two different political parties who both basically kind of sighed when I asked them what their political affiliation was because they hadn't announced it. You know, they had announced on Facebook that they wanted to run but hadn't specified which party they're from. And they both had very similar reactions. Like, they were frustrated that this had to be a partisan issue. And New Hanover County is one of, I think, 30 to 40 of the school districts across the state that is actually partisan. The majority of them are not. But I think some of the overriding issues were obviously sort of mending the fractured makeup of the board right now. There's still a lot to be dealt with in terms of the, you know, child abuse scandals over the last couple of years. And scandal's probably even the wrong word. Just the way it was handled.
I'm sorry. I know there are other news organizations, and I'm sorry, that use that word, especially sex scandal. And it's not. That is not what it is.
Yeah.
This is a story of child abuse. It's, you know, so sorry. Always something that's bothered me.
That is a valid interjection. I think scandal makes it sound like something tawdry happened, and instead you had systematic.
And perhaps there were consenting adults, and they're not. We're talking about children.
Exactly. It's why the FBI doesn't call child porn anymore. It calls it, you know, child exploitation imagery.
Right.
And, you know, but basically what we were looking at was a systemically broken administration, which has some new faces now, and it's not clear where we go from here. So,
And they're also facing that additional challenge now of at-risk kids who are even more likely to fall through the cracks with remote learning and, you know, what may happen
Absolutely.
With the coronavirus this fall and winter.
Yeah, and I think because the headlines have focused on child abuse over the last 2 to 3 years, it's sometimes easy for people to forget that we're also dealing with the achievement gap, we're also dealing with teacher pay, we're also dealing with redistricting, and I think we'll see all those issues be back on the table for the Board of Ed in the next couple of years.
Right. I want to circle back for a second to North Carolina Senate District 8. That is incumbent Republican Senator Bill Rabin, one of the most powerful people in the state legislature, versus challenger David Sink. This is the second time Sink has challenged Rabin. I haven't seen Rabin emerge yet for any kind of public debates facing his challenger. Have you?
I have not. And let me just put the question to you, perhaps keeping in mind Brunswick County's pretty red backdrop. Do you think he needs to?
No. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I don't think he does. And I think that's one of the frustrations, because I think you and I don't want to speak for you, but we like to see policymakers show up and talk to their constituents. And one of the ways that they do that is through the news media. And so that's been particularly frustrating for me, because I see that as part of the mandate.
I agree.
That
I
they
always think
take on.
Yeah. I always think tested ideas are better than untested ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I just want to note that in Brunswick County, we are looking at a county commission race. Brunswick County, different from New Hanover County, is broken into districts. Mike Forte got called out for a racist post. The NAACP called for his resignation. Brunswick County Democrats organized a protest rally. He's unopposed on the ballot, the only candidate in District 4. So that's not a contest. And that music tells us that we are out of time. Ben Schachtman, that's this edition of WHQR's special election coverage. Thanks for doing this with me today.
Rachel, thanks. I was very happy to be here. And of course, look forward next week. We'll have plenty of information from the polls, coverage, election night, and follow-up information the rest of the week. So stay tuned.
That's right. This special edition of election coverage was produced by No One. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. You can get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn.
And I'm Ben Schachtman.